Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by my permanent co-host and the only co-host that ever matters, Justin Robert Young.
Oh, it's happy to be here. Brian is preparing for his TEDx talk tomorrow. He might join us for a little bit after things, but it is just me and you, Andrew, as we do Weird Things, and it is a celebratory Weird Things, right?
It's pretty exciting week, in general, other than the terrifying things have been going on between, Houston hurricane heading towards our family in Florida.
Yep.
And the, brush fires out here in Burbank, where I could stand out in front of my house and watch what looked like Mordor. Other than that, things are great.
Other than that, of course, yeah, the world is falling apart, but
there's this theory that my buddy Ken Montgomery, as you know, the guy you replaced is my friend.
Yeah.
I have this sort of weird fight off thing I make my friends go through.
By the way, make your friends go through means you just harass your friends, old and new, by just calling them either old and new versions of their other of their names, right? So
I only have a capacity to like keep like track of one relationship at a time. So it's my buddy Ken, when I got like my first big deal was like my first big cruise ship job. I was a teenager and I got hired to work on a ship for like 6 months, really well paid, whatever. Ken went to go see me off, and then like he was there at the airport, whatever, and then I think he overslept or something, and he got fired from his job at the movie theater, right?
Oh, no. Oh, Ken,
When I got my Japan contract, he got fired from some other job for something or whatever. It was just this, it was like we said that like whenever something good happened to me, something bad happened to Ken.
Okay.
And so when I got the TV show, I'm like, you've been to the doctor, right?
Yeah.
You're good. Okay. And so it's this weird karmic kind of thing, maybe. I don't know. I'm sorry.
So wait, hold on. Wait, is Ken dead? Like, is this your way of telling me that Ken died?
Ken survived that one. Ken survived that.
Well, then, I mean, you have good news. Like, why are you dancing around this? Tell everybody the great news.
So, I mean, you know, I'm a modest guy, and I hate to toot my own
sure.
horn.
Sure.
But as we speak, the number one book on Amazon is The Naturalist.
The
my
what?
Book.
The,
my book,
wait,
The Naturalist.
Whoa. Hold on. Wait a minute. So you're telling me if people go to Kindle bestsellers, right? They just Google that, the top books that are the top Kindle books on Amazon, full stop, right? Like,
well, top books, actually all books, including Kindle, all books. And if they do this right now, if they do this like 12 hours from now or whatever. But I mean, it was all day. It was for 2 or 3 days, for 3 days straight. It was nonstop. Yesterday dipped down to number two. Then right now it's number one again, but we'll see. But yes, the answer is I've had for 4 days now, I've had the number one book on Amazon.
Look at that. Number one, Top of the Plow, Gosh Darn Humdinger, Gold Cup, Blue Ribbon, Giant Foam Finger. Number one, The Naturalist by Andrew Main. You are the champion, my friend.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of cool.
well, here, all right. So, where do we want to put this? Let's let everybody know that you can go ahead and buy The Naturalist right now, Kindle paperback. It is now for sale. And is the Kindle first thing still going on?
Yeah. So the Kindle first thing is all this month. My book was selected as one of the thriller mystery for that, which means that if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, the United States, UK, or Australia, you can download it for free. You can get it free as part of being an Amazon Prime member, which certainly helped my book because it doesn't come out till October 1st. Let's not kid around as far as But a number of books get selected for that every month. And I'm very, very fortunate because I have the awesome support of people out there like our listeners, et cetera, that just jumped right into the book and said very nice things about it, which I'm very grateful for.
And by the way, the reviews on this, these are user reviews that have come in, have kept this thing at 4.5 stars, right? Like this is extraordinarily well reviewed.
Yeah, it's been very, very well received. I'm very happy with that. You know, when you write something that you're passionate about, you just hope that it connects with people. And I feel very, very lucky by that. You know, we do a podcast where we like to mix kind of cool stuff and science and all that. And as you know, when I started writing, I wanted to sort of take a little bit of spirit of what Weird Things was about and put that into my writing. So
100%. Now, this was something that all right, so do we want to get into some of the business stuff now or on after things?
I say we do that in After Things.
Okay.
We'll get some cool, weird stories. I don't want to bore people to death with this, but you can check out, if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, you can get The Naturalist for free right now as part of your Prime membership, or you can pre-order it. It comes out October 1st in paperback, Kindle version, audiobook, MP3 audio, et cetera. But right now, the Kindle version's free for Amazon Prime subscribers. So, as a Kindle first selection. And if you like it, please leave a review. If you read something else that's not mine and you like what they did, please write a review.
Really, really. We are pro reviews. Pro reviews here.
I write reviews. I endorse stuff all the time because I want to support things. And I know how much it matters to me when I get a good review and somebody supports what I'm doing. Because it's just, you have no idea how much influence you have with just one really good review. You really, really have, more than the books editor for a local newspaper, in all seriousness. Particularly when a book first launches and is out there.
Let me just say, this is something that is extraordinarily, I'm so extraordinarily proud of your achievement here. This is a fantastic book. And listen, the reviews bear it out. I mean, this thing has been in people's hands now for the Kindle side for a little bit, for the last couple of days since this has been up here. You have been spent the majority of the last 4 days, the vast majority of the past 4 days at the number one spot. There are a lot of eyeballs on this, and the word is coming back extraordinarily positive. So I am thrilled to see how this is going.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the support of everybody out there. But you know what?
What?
Let's talk about a really amazing achievement.
Let's go.
Peggy Whitson. Peggy Whitson is a rock star. Peggy Whitson is kind of really awesome and rocking and amazing. She returned to Earth today. She spent 665 days on board the International Space Station, breaking all kinds of records, breaking the record for an American astronaut. The Russians hold the record, but they kind of leave their guys up there and forget they're there. But she broke the record for that. 665 days in space. And I'm going to say this, not that it matters, but it's kind of cool. She's 56. If you're thinking about, like, man, what am I going to do with my life? What am I going to do? This woman, 56, which qualifies as retirement in many federal departments and agencies, and is somebody who could run laps around Justin and I, the superhuman specimen of a person, has done an amazing achievement. The record for a U.S. astronaut in space has been set by Peggy. Happens to be a woman, not that it's important, but just so you know, kind of really rocking and awesome. So, and she did a lot of great science up there. I am, as you know, I'm super, super into space science and microgravity research. And that's what just gets me so excited, is the idea of having a researcher up there able to do some interesting stuff. She did some stuff involving plant growth, eye development, et cetera, not to mention what she volunteered her own body. Her own body is a research subject. Her own body is being used to measure the effects of long-term exposure in space. I mean, that's almost 2 years in space, 2 years in weightlessness, which is kind of cool. And she also became the oldest woman astronaut to complete a spacewalk. It's not like she just sat around inside. She went out and got stuff done. So hats off to a hero, space hero, Peggy Whitson. That's just amazing.
That's crazy. And how old again?
56.
56 years old, and now has the record. Do you think that this is something that certainly a monumental achievement in the age that she has earned it in. But you would imagine that hopefully this is a record that gets broken sooner rather than later as we send more people into space within the next, you know, certainly the next 20, 30 years, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, she, like Mark Kelly, who was another one person to longevity, and the cosmonauts have been up there. They're trailblazers. It's harder for them to do this now than it will be later on because we don't know enough about this. It's still, what are the right exercises? What are the right vitamins? How do you prevent the deteriorating effects? And so that, yeah, these records are going to be broken again and again, and we're eventually going to have people who are born in space and live there, but hopefully in some sort of, you know, gravity environment.
Sure.
But what they're doing right now is making it possible for the rest of us to go up there and have a safer experience in future astronauts, et cetera. So, yeah, it's going to get, you know, it's the first transatlantic fight, you know, when Lindbergh did that, kind of cool.
You know?
I mean, cool if he wasn't such a, you know, a racist, but, you know, kind of an amazing achievement. You know, you and I've done that now, and nobody was there to cheer us and pop champagne bottles for us.
Yeah, yeah, no, seriously. So, is this kind of comparable to a pioneer? Like is this the, you know, the Oregon Trail of our era? People that have trailblazed what it's like to spend this much time in space?
Certainly think so. I think that it's pushing the limits of human endeavor in places that, you know, are just beyond what we've done before, you know? And I think that, all right, this mission was 288 days. I think it's cumulatively she's done 665 days.
Uh-huh.
Just to correct, make a correction there. But yeah, I think that what's happening right now is kind of an amazing, achievement. And she broke the record back in April for an American astronaut, but she stayed an extra 3 months because she felt like it. She wanted to stay, you know, 3 months longer in space. And that's, you know, that kind of dedication to make things happen is just kind of phenomenal.
That is fantastic. So a big, big hats off. And now she is back on Earth, safe and sound.
Yep. Back on Earth after taking a Soyuz reentry, which is always apparently very, very nerve wracking. So kind of incredible. So what a great hero to us all. And just. To anybody listening out there who has, you know, some ambition, something you want to do, it's, you know, your peak years are way ahead of you.
Sure. Absolutely. And listen, she is a hero for all of us, somebody that we can all look up to and take strength from. But you can also be a hero. That is if you go ahead and support us at patreon.com/weirdthings. That is where you get the chance to make sure that we continue to rock this show each and every week. In fact, it can be said that if it were not for patreon.com/weirdthings, you know, maybe this would have been a chance to take a week off. You know, there's a lot that's going on. Brian has a TEDx talk coming up. Bryce got some really funky con crud from Dragon Con. I just got back in town from Dragon Con as well, but the beat must go on because you guys have chosen to support us at patreon.com/weirdthings, where not only do you get the smile in your heart that you made sure that this show kept going, you also get early access to the show and access to After Things, which is our creative endeavor that we do right after Weird Things. So go ahead and check us out. patreon.com/weirdthings.
Justin, I want you to imagine that you've taken a different path in your life, maybe one that's led you to the other side of the law.
Oh, and, okay. I'm an outlaw.
Okay. Maybe you've stolen a car. Maybe you've, committed a robbery. Maybe you've done something that you shouldn't have done. And you decide that you're going to try to flee the cops. The cops are chasing after you, right?
Okay.
And then you say, you know what I'm going to do is you're getting pulled over because maybe you have something in your car you shouldn't have, whatever. And you see the ocean. And you're like, you know what? I'm going to swim for it.
You're going to swim. Okay. All right. So I'm I'm on the run from the fuzz. I know I'm guilty. I'm going to go to jail. I'm now in the ocean. I'm going to try and swim for my life, really.
And I'm going to send you a link in a moment here. And I kept thinking this has got to be a hoax, and I'm waiting to find out that it is a hoax. But as far as I can tell, this is actually like a real thing. So you're out there swimming away from the cops, and you're kind of like, all right, guys, got away. Suck it, maybe roll around to flip them off, whatever. What would be the worst thing that could happen short of death?
Okay, so short, obviously, listen, you're putting yourself in the situation where if you are not a good swimmer or you have some other kind of injury, that obviously drowning is going to be a large possibility.
The police send up a drone to follow you.
Oh, wow.
Like, oh, you think you're going to get away? We got a drone to follow you because this is the future. Maybe you forgot. It's the future.
Number one, I'll be immediately surprised as I remember it's indeed the future. And now the buzzing that I'm hearing is not a upset hornet's nest or beehive. It is indeed a drone that is trailing me. All right. The worst thing that can happen, short of death, would be to be maimed by some kind of animal. And immediately what pops to mind is that I am attacked by a shark.
I want you to check your email, and I want you to click on a link there. And it didn't get so dire. It didn't get that dire, but they're watching the footage of this man fleeing away from the cops. And what do they see?
I'm going to play this for everybody. Here we go. The headline from Port City Daily is drone footage. Man flees Surf City police by swimming a mile out to sea. He is then pursued by a shark. Let's go ahead and go to this footage here. We are watching this man swimming to avoid police. Oh, my God. There would look to be something behind him. Wait a minute.
Is it in the lower part of the frame there?
Yeah, the lower part of the frame. Hold on, wait. Let me pull this.
Yeah, lower right, you can see.
Let me pull this
right
out
above
here.
The YouTube logo. He's being shadowed by a shark.
Oh my Lanta! Here we go. Yep. All right, lower right hand portion, and I'll zoom in on it in a second. But there we go. He is being shadowed by a shark. To his right, let's go ahead and enhance. Obviously, there is the man right there, but let's also go ahead and take a look. This is, say hello to his little friend. We can see that guy. Oh, my God. And he doesn't even know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, the police canine shark unit. We got drones. We got sharks.
Oh, my God.
But I, you know, it's funny as I said it flippantly because it's the future. It makes sense. I didn't realize it. Like, police are now like, oh, you're going to get away. Okay, pull out the drone and we'll just track you with this.
I mean, it's kind of brilliant, right? Because, even in Los Angeles, famously, there is this culture of police chases, right? And it winds up getting coverage, and the local television uses their helicopters to keep track of it. It is riveting television and yet horrifyingly unsafe for everybody involved, including innocent bystanders that just happen to be on these highways. But when you think about it, The drone kind of solves all those problems, right? Somebody is on the road. Okay, fine. We'll just keep a drone. It'll be over you. There won't be flashing lights. It'll just follow you to where you're going. And eventually we'll just figure it out. We'll find out where you are. And then we'll send the SWAT in to make sure that you get brought to justice.
And then the sharks. Send the sharks in, too.
And then, of course, if you try to jump into the marina and swim to some... I mean, where else are you going? Like, is your friend running some renegade riverboat gambling operation that you're going to jump in, or you're going to find a cigarette boat that'll take you out to international waters?
Maybe he's Aquaman. Maybe this is the beginning of a Justice League viral video.
Sure, yeah. But if he's Aquaman, then he has nothing to worry about with the shark, right?
Yeah, they're friends. Unless he like works for like Mantis or whatever the enemy is. I forget my Aquaman lore.
Or maybe it's finally the Namor or Namor Aquaman fight that we've been spoiling for all these years.
Dare to dream. Justin, are you feeling a little bit anxious, a little bit unnerved right now?
I'm a fairly anxious person, so yeah, that's usually a fairly safe bet.
You know, I went on Saturday and I saw in the big screen Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, wow.
A friend of mine, Paul Hynek, his father is the J. Allen Hynek who wrote Project Blue Book, which Steven Spielberg got the rights to and then used that as a starting point to make the movie Close Encounters. Because Spielberg in the post-Watergate era wanted to do a story about a conspiracy of what if the government was hiding evidence of aliens, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a great story. I'm inclined to believe the answer to that is a firm no.
Sure.
But it's fun. And the movie's wonderful. Even watching the movie, I have the movie on, I have it on Blu-ray. I have it on, you know, digital. And I've had both versions of it or multiple versions of it. I love watching. It was great to watch it again in the theaters because it's an extremely well done Spielberg movie. You see things that he understood great, like characters talking over each other. A very realistic domestic kind of life, etc. But aliens.
Yeah.
The idea that they're out there. And kind of what was cool that he did was Spielberg made the encounter with them so more grandiose and strange than just a UFO lands. Like, hey, we're aliens. It was still mysterious. You know, the movie ended with like, we don't know anything about them.
Yeah.
You know? Which is cool.
Which, I mean, like, we know as much about those aliens at the end of the movie as natives would Europeans as they come to the, you know, the shores of the United States, right? And it's just a foreign concept of people that are, they speak different, cultures are different, their concepts are all different. It's just, it's, you know, there's no reason why there should be some plot device where somebody mind melds and is like, oh, finally, I get everything.
We've been searching the skies for evidence of extraterrestrials. And it's one of these things that I think people who often believers of more extreme points of view on it, that think they're convinced that they're here, they're visiting us, kind of create straw man argument and say like, well, it's ridiculous to think that we're all alone. It's like, the only people I've ever met that think that we would be all alone in the universe tend to be maybe people like myself who suggest it just because of just the probabilistic chances and the likelihood of developing, is intelligent life tool making things like we do? Is it really the end point of evolution or not? I don't know. And I'm not against the idea. I think the universe is so big, it would seem likely there would be all sorts of things out there because it's really, really huge. I've never encountered a religious person that was convinced that we were all alone. In fact, most religious people I know would think that, well, you know, if God created Earth, why wouldn't he create other worlds? Scientists, you know, generally think that like, you know, they might be like, well, that more dismissive on the idea that we'd ever make contact. But the idea the universe is so big and the evidence for life being able to form seems to be, you know, overwhelming. I don't know anybody who thinks that we're all alone, who's convinced 100% that we're all alone. I'm probably the most skeptical person I know about that. And let me play devil's advocate because we take some things and assume that they're easier than others.
Sure. But,
so, you know, the idea that, you know, every NASA scientist, everybody I talk to, you know, they're all like, yeah, it would be more odd if there was no other life out there. And even intelligent life, given the size of the universe. So, there have been a number of projects like Project Steady, and then there's been another search. Yuri Milner, who is a Russian billionaire, who has funded a telescope array project to try to look for signs of intelligent life out there. And one of the things that's happened has been we've observed these fast radio bursts. And fast radio bursts are pretty much what they sound like. There are a series of radio bursts coming from one specific spot that, in this case, coming from the direction of a distant galaxy, which is, you know, kind of even more peculiar and odd. And so what's happened is we've had just on August 26th, we had another series of these that were observed. And it's peculiar because 15 pulses were detected within 5 hours, and they have, like, you know, 500 terabytes of data were collected on this. And they have a lot of different theories on what this could be, but no strong front runner from this. The scientists at Breakthrough Listen, which is the project that observed this, which is actually a project trying to listen for intelligent life, they think that it's probably a natural phenomenon. You know, we don't understand it, but we're kind of the idea that it's probably a natural phenomenon because, you know, it's such a massive scale and doesn't seem like it's something that's directed at us. But it could be neutron stars, black holes, et cetera. But they don't think that it's likely to be ETs. But it's just evidence of just how weird and strange the universe is. And right now, what that and this is to show you, these are the people looking for an alien life.
Yeah.
And they're like, nah, we don't think this is alien. We don't know what this is, but we're not going to be like, it's aliens. But what it does tell us, though, is that, you know, a thing we've discussed here is that if we do get evidence of alien life, it may not be one day we're like, hey, we're alone. The next day, like, hey, we proof. We know everything we know. It might be a weird signal that we're thinking that it could be. And there's been, you know, more talk about the idea that it could be a slow realization of we're listening to an alien civilization.
So if that is the case, at what point do we say this has gone from, all right, this is a bunch of random noise, to holy crap, this is really a thing? Like, what is that threshold? What needs to happen?
You know, if we're picking up a signal, and let's say, and we've talked about the difference between intentional signals and unintentional signals. If it's an unintentional signal and we're picking up what may be, you know, a radio communications burst or something from another planet, which would be kind of hard if it wasn't directed at us. But if we did pick something up and we got a fragment of something, we're going to have a bunch of questions. Did it really come from there? That'll be the big one. Did it really, really come from there? In the book Contact, you know, the movie Contact, kind of people fell upon, well, we think it was a hoax by this guy who's not unlike Yuri Milner, this billionaire who was trying to find it. And they kind of, people sort of cited, you know what, maybe it was a hoax after all, right?
Yeah.
Because it was just, the evidence was not overwhelmingly there. You spend a long time with fragments of evidence trying to think, maybe there's something here, maybe. And then you have the sea change and everybody's like, yeah, of course, we do all along. And it's like, wait,
yeah,
we didn't. And now we forget that period of indeterminacy. So I think what would happen is, if we got a fragmentary signal and let's say it had images or other stuff like that, we're going to, one, try to determine, did it really come from there? That'll be a big question. Could this have been fake? Could this have been spoofed? Then we're going to be very curious about the algorithms. Like, if we got just a basic, like just a simple image, we'll be like, you know, were we trying to decode this with systems that had a bias? Were they going to just try to find an image no matter what? What happens if we put other data in there? It's this, we'll go through this period of just not knowing. It'll become a matter of like, maybe this, maybe that, if it's a fragment.
Yeah.
And then maybe it'll build over time.
I mean, wow. I guess I can't even wrap my head around what the cultural impact of that would be. Like what does the day after we get something like that, is it like at some point it breaks out of the science nerd category and becomes just the biggest story on the planet, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in my very limited mind, and I'm going to be wrong, but I see three. If we get contact, either there's an unintentional contact, which is going to be very frustrating and very confusing because we're not going to have a certainty about it, and it's going to be confusing. If you just got, you know, a test pattern signal from us, you know, if you've got, if you manage to get just 2 minutes of a cell phone conversation and not knowing anything about English or whatever, you might, you know, wonder, you know, yeah, maybe there's a species of whale on some other planet that uses, you know, electromagnetic communication, and for some reason it got boosted, or it's a star, it's a star quake and a very weird thing. There are a lot of phenomenon that sound organic, but they're not. And if you have no experience with what's creating it, then who knows? But if we had an intentional signal, it could be one of three. Again, I'm wrong on this, but in my mind, be one of three scenarios. You either have a singular civilization, you know, like us, that develops the ability to contact.
Yeah.
Okay. which it could be very, very alien and very, very bizarre because, you know, if you haven't contacted other civilizations, there's a learning curve. I would, you know, we had a learning curve. Our best explorers were people that had contacted other civilizations and said, you've got to learn their customs. You've got to learn, you know, how to speak their language. You've got to adapt very quickly. Don't make a lot of assumptions about how similar you are and they are. You know, and you look at there's an interesting movie right now, Scorsese's The Silence, which is about some Jesuits going in search of another one in Japan, in, you know, feudal Japan, in a period in which Japan was extremely isolated. And it's a very alien environment, extremely alien environment that is resistant to change. They had killed all the other priests before because the feudal warlords are like, you know what? We don't want any outside. We like what we're doing. We don't want you coming in here and changing things. And these are people who are, you know, genetically the same as us.
Yeah.
But in that period of time, it was, you know, more alien than you could even imagine. When conquistadors came to South America, encountered these massive civilizations that have been thriving for hundreds of years, it was, and we're the same, you know, but it was alien. So you imagine an alien civilization that is totally divergent from us, totally different from us. Even if they have a high level of technology, they may have arrived at it from a very different point of view. Yeah, it's alien is the word. It's going to be utterly alien. That is the one scenario. Second scenario is if you've encountered alien civilizations that have contacted other alien civilizations, then it's different. When you go to major cities that have been port cities, let's say Hong Kong, Shanghai, you know, Miami, et cetera, you see a lot of similarities because cultures that have to deal with other cultures learn very quickly how to get along.
Yeah.
How to get along and sort of function that way. And you can feel, you know, if you want to go somewhere and travel, if you go to a port city that gets a lot of traffic, you're going to be fine. I'm not saying fine, but it's easier to get there because they're used to strangers. So cultures that are a combination of cultures, if it's multiple aliens, whatever, then yeah, that'll be different. They're going to be a little bit smarter in how to deal with us and have a little more savvy on that. Third scenario, if it's AI.
Okay. So it's an artificial intelligence that is now communicating with us. Then, I mean, how do we even, where do we even go from there?
Well, in the other situations, it could be an AI acting as an intermediary, but if it's an AI that's sort of taken over or, you know, a dominant AI or whatever, then it's like, I have no idea. You know, it's going to be like it could be benevolent. It could be not even care, won't even communicate, only communicates to send us viruses and stuff to take over or whatever. But who knows? Whatever scenario I can imagine is not what it is.
Oh my God. What would you prefer? All right, I'm giving you the choice. What would be the one that would bring, I guess, either more prosperity or less risk to Earth if they communicated and therefore insinuating that we could go further with our communication with them?
Multicultural.
That's what we're rooting for.
Yeah. The culture from the Ian Banks type novels, that kind of thing, you know, a less fascist version of the Federation or the United Federation of Planets, you know, a more whatever kind of thing. That's what I would think would be the best case scenario. It's a sort of like an organization based on trade. Trade is wonderful. Trade is saying you can do something. You're different. And by the very nature of you being different, you have things that are of value to us.
There's value there. Yeah. We can not just be useless.
Yeah, exactly. So that'd be my preference. You know, I think that would be the best case scenario.
I'm going to have to go ahead and agree. Although really, the AI example is just the one that's just so out there that, you know, We don't know. We don't know how we will react to AI or how AI will react to us. You know, it's just a big guessing game where really the most cautious are just like, hey, we don't know where this goes, but we know how bad the bad side of this can go. So we need to, on our end, in the development of it, be very cautious. Did you read the Putin quote that the people that create the most sophisticated AI will rule the world?
Yeah. And, you know, Elon Musk talking about, you know, World War III would be about AI. I Yeah, I think there is something to that. I think that it is a you know, and Brian's not here, so we don't get, you know, the full variety of opinions that we normally have on that, because yeah. You know, Brian and I sort of take different points of view on that. So I won't speak for him on that. But my, you know, my take on it is that, you know, when we think about AI, a sophisticated AI is a lot of complex systems working together. And part of those systems are being able to, you know, we as humans, we've evolved because we try to repair damage in our DNA and we try to improve upon how we function our environment. Humans are not the same that we were for what we were designed for 100 billion years ago or a million years ago, et cetera. You know, 100 million years ago, we were, you know, monkeys,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, then we lost our tails like other apes and, you know, evolved with, you know, and had a common ancestor, other apes, and became us and then diverged. And so we're an example of software that's constantly rewriting itself. You're born and you have this example, but Gen 2, Gen 3, your children, your progeny change and evolve over time to whatever is the maximum, you know, utility. And it depends on what that is. You know, when you're talking about an AI agent, there's several scary situations. One is you just develop a really, really great, brilliant, or really powerful AI program that does a purpose that says, hey, cripple the United States economy.
Yeah. And go.
And it's go. Which it says, oh, I'm going to look for all sorts of open ports and financial systems. I'm going to hack JP Morgan, all these other places. I'm going to have them start making really ridiculous trades. And I'm going to bankrupt these systems, forcing people to have to restart, you know, the Dow Jones, the NASDAQ, whatever. Meanwhile, I'm going to collapse pension funds and I'm going to send, you know, cause unemployment, et cetera, blah, 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 which on one hand sounds a little bit, well, if you're looking at, if you're following machine learning and you're following how quickly these things, computers are learning how to, in simple situations, think like people, it's not that far-fetched. It's really, really not.
Yeah. You know, I you would almost bet that if you look at the frequency of, you know, these blackmail operations, you know, this is happening. I would say that, number one, a lot of it doesn't come out because people pay blackmail and it doesn't get reported on, right? But mm-hmm. I think it is an underreported element of our society right now that could have tremendous ramifications, because I do not think it is far-fetched for us to have something that greatly affects key financial institutions, well, be it through espionage from other countries or just rogue outfits. Because, again, it's the people that wield the sword that really have the power. There's no guarantee that they're going to be loyal to national constructs.
You know, I'll give you, and we've talked about it before, and I don't know if everybody sort of knows the story of Stuxnet. And
yeah.
And not to say that I'm an expert on it, which I'm not, but when the Iranians were working towards developing their own nuclear weapons, one of the most critical things you need to do is you need to take uranium and you got to refine it, because actually the rock, the ore you get, the useful part of the uranium that you want, the isotope you want, is in a very, very, very small quantity in there. And essentially what you do is you put it inside of a centrifuge and spin it for days and weeks and whatnot in separating the heavier elements from the lighter elements. That's how you refine uranium. So Iran had hundreds of centrifuges they were using to process uranium so they could refine it and then get the core uranium. Once you have that uranium, you can do dirty bombs, you can make a regular atomic bomb, etc. Certain parties, of which we don't know who they are, but we kind of know who they are,
yeah,
were not happy about the idea of Iran getting a nuclear bomb.
Let's take a just for laughs, call them Shmamerica and Shmizriel.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
Shmamerica-Israel decided, yeah, this would not be in our best intentions, because this is a country that is openly hostile towards us and them. You know, when their leaders, their political platforms aren't, you know, we're going to be number one, we're going to destroy these other countries. Now, granted, it's kind of what you have to say to, you know, maintain power there.
Yeah.
But you're getting power because there are a lot of people that want to hear you say you're going to destroy us.
Yeah.
So what do you do? And, you know, there had been a number of cases where, you know, Iran would build a nuclear facility and then people, you know, jets would maybe leave Israel and go bomb that facility and then bring it back down to the Stone Age. There are other examples of, you know, you might be a leading Iranian nuclear scientist and you hop into your motorcade and you're in your limousine and you're being carried from one place to the next. And you hear the sound of a motorcycle whizzing by and thunk, something gets attached to the door of your car.
Yeah.
And moments later, a bomb goes off. And
the next thing you know, there is no car or you.
Yeah. So those are some of the things, the goal of which was, you know, to prevent Iran from doing this. But one of the more clever things was these centrifuge systems, which were built by, I forget, like Siebold or Dunn, I forget who built these, but these are run by computers. These are computer controlled centrifuges and they're networked and they have to have software updates and et cetera to keep going. At some point, a worm, not a virus, but technically a worm infected the centrifuges and got into one of the system, and it was a cleverly designed piece of software designed to spread from computer to computer to computer. And it was like, well, if you're a centrifuge and you're in Iran, we've got a new way for you to work. Yeah. And they cause these things. And a centrifuge is a motor, big electric motor, and it's a cylinder, and it spins it at ridiculously high speeds. This worm was causing these centrifuges to spin extremely fast and break apart and basically just destroyed them.
Yeah.
Centrifuge and destroyed like their entire program for a while and spread. And they would try to take them offline and put other ones into place. And the worm would show up magically back inside of there and do this.
So here Stuxnet, we go. This is from Wikipedia. Stuxnet has three modules, a worm that executes all routines related to the main payload of the attack, a link file that automatically executes the propagated copies of the worm, and a rootkit component responsible for hiding all malicious files and processes, preventing detection and the presence of Stuxnet. It is introduced via a USB flash drive. So that's all you needed, is to get somebody into where those are networked, stick in a USB flash drive, and you are good to go.
That's one of the ways in which you can introduce things.
Yeah.
And there are other systems at play too, because once you stop like a human engineer and you just start thinking about systems in general, you realize that, oh, you know, I could put a little piece of software on board somebody's computer that all it did was open up the microphone port and listen.
Yeah.
And not have anything else there. But at some point, if it gets a series of commands, you know, a couple of different pitch tones and maybe an ultrasonic frequency by somebody's cell phone in there, it can all of a sudden start to write a program to a file. This has been done. This is the thing. And you would think like, no, my computer's not networked. It's not plugged in. Oh, guess what? You've got a microphone port, or you got Bluetooth. You know, if you don't even have your Bluetooth on, whatever, but if you have a microphone port on there. But there can be other things too, is you could have you could say, I've shut down all of my ports. I'm like, okay, you've got a temperature sensor in there. Okay. Yeah. You're going to still have some things monitoring some forms of RF. You've actually got a keyboard. You may have a camera, but you tape over the camera, but maybe the camera, you could have a camera. Imagine this. You have a camera, but you put a post-it note over the camera, right? So it can't see anything. Okay.
Sure.
I could still, if I had a little tiny bit of code inside of there, I could hack your computer. If I had a bit of code that was looking for, if all of a sudden I controlled the light grid and I turned lights on and off.
Yeah.
And I could send a series of Morse code and do this. Again, these are dumb ideas for me. The people doing this have good ideas, you know, and that's the world we're living in. And we've had actual examples in the laboratory of artificial intelligence systems figuring out how to hack other systems. They've figured out like, oh, you know, I can hack this other computer. I can listen to what it's saying because it's giving off this RF frequency. I can influence it because I found out that I can cause this change there, et cetera. There's a thing called Rowhammer. We talked about Rowhammer before.
I don't think we have.
So let's say you have a microchip, right? Okay. And you say, this is a super secure microchip. I use encryption. This thing's totally locked down. You're not going to be able to hack my computer because of this. Now, I can send requests to your computer, though. I can go to you have an open port, and I can say, hey, you know, can I have access? Your computer can go, no, you may not. I'm like, all right, can I have access now? No, you may not. Well, on that microchip, the thing is that you have rows of transistors that are physically close to other transistors. And one row of transistors might be part of an open part of the chip, and that other row of transistors is part of a closed part of the chip. Now, in theory, this microchip, there's no way you could hack it. There's no way, because you'd need a super huge encryption algorithm. You've checked everything. But physically, if I send a series of requests to that row of transistors over and over again, I can actually get one of those transistors on that other side to maybe malfunction, to flip a bit or whatever, to do something it's not supposed to do and cause a critical error.
Yeah.
This has been done in the laboratory. This has actually been done in the laboratory where they've actually been able to hack, quote, unhackable chips by going, well, let's attack this on a hardware level. Let's just create something that on paper, you wouldn't think that this could, you know, be like, there's no problem. But once you realize, wait, those rows are really close together, and it's just, and that's just the one approach.
Well, and so that's, and that's one of those things that, you know, is always so fascinating about guys who educate and talk about and communicate on this, like Darren Kitchen. When you talk about hacking, A, I think that we are entering a point now, and this is something that's been a great pet peeve of mine in terms of reporting about stuff like this, that we just lump everything into hacking, right?
Yeah.
And I think that does a tremendous disservice to readers and listeners and viewers when we use terms that are very broad, like hacking, to encompass everything, to say, yeah, and I'll use political metaphors because that's what everybody is aware of now. But spear phishing, which is something that happened with, you know, emails from the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta, is far different than infecting a voting machine or something like that, or affecting stuff like that. And you use the same term for it, and it doesn't really make sense. But if we are to use that broad term correctly, and this is something that Darren Kitchen talks often about, is it brings a lot more clarity as to what hacking, the broad idea is, which is just taking advantage of soft spots in a system, be it talking to somebody, be it in the mail, be it in email, be it in hardware. If you can determine where the system can break down, where you can penetrate that system, that is the idea of hacking. And it necessitates as 360 of a worldview as possible, because you've exactly hit it, hit the nail on the head with that example. If the software is indeed impenetrable, then think about the hardware. How do you get access to somebody's email? Because somebody has to answer the email, and they might give you the password. Like that is the larger kind of concept of it. And I wish that we talked more. When we refer to hacking, we would talk about it more in that sense and less in the very specific, narrow sense of somebody got spearfished, somebody compromised a voting machine, stuff like that.
You know, I'm going to give another example is if you use Gmail on your phone.
Yeah.
If you looked at that responses on the bottom, if I sent you a Gmail right now that says, do you want to go to lunch?
Yeah.
You know what appears below?
The little autofill yes or no kind of thing, or
yeah, and those are, and that's actually Ray Kurzweil works on the program that developed that. Ray Kurzweil is a big, you know, artificial intelligence pioneer, a guy who said some very amazing, you know, predictions. We'll see if they come true on where we're going to be, and he may be a little bit off, but some stuff is very poignant. And so what they've developed is this system that contextually looks at what your email is and says, okay, what is the likely response that you want to this? And often it's gotten beyond just yes or no, or it can be like, yeah, send it to me, or this is great. It knows it's talking about a thing. So this is a very simple set of AI, but it's an AI that is trying to determine the context of something being sent to you and to respond. And so if we want to develop, you know, a malicious AI that could use spear phishing, whatever, it can learn very quickly. It can send a 1,000 emails to people and say, you know, what gets the best response back, then adapt and change. And then it's we're watching that right now between, you know, Alexa, Siri, Google Voice, et cetera. But looking just in your little email box, you can see that you have a system there that's trying desperately to understand what the conversation is about. This is where it is now.
Yeah. And that's the thing is it's trying to figure out what happens when it does. And we are at a level now where it is retail distributed. This isn't just stuff happening in labs, right? And that's the biggest thing. What happened between the years of when, you know, DARPANET and you know, AOL and the open internet and stuff like that, You know, when everybody gets their hands on it, oh boy.
Well, and that's the fear, is the idea of the bad actor. It's one thing when we talk about, like, hey, if we develop the really cool AI that's going to help us, that's great. But before then, you can get these semi-useful AI that do one thing really well in the hands of bad actors. And there are people out there that will do that. And that's the scary situation, is what happens with, you know, the person doing the malevolent thing with it.
Tinvec in the chat says, as I mentioned earlier, I think that by the time we get to an AI that could be scary, it will stop caring about us and move on.
I don't agree with that. I think Stuxnet's scary to me, and it's barely even an AI. Stuxnet got outside of what I think. I understand why we did it, but it started infecting other systems. It's already, these things are, you know, we have worms and viruses that are out there causing problems. And you have, you know, you look at these things that are, you know, when you get your computer infected and you find your files have been encrypted because it's actually just a piece of software that arguably is borderline AI that's doing it, it's already a threat. It's already a threat. Things are going in there looking for vulnerable systems, looking for exploits and doing that. Too late, man. It's already happening. So I don't think, I think people tend to think of the super smart mustache twirling AI.
Yeah.
I'm talking about smarter viruses, smarter worms that somebody says.
Just big, you know, what big dumb bully AI.
Yeah, you know, the one that just, you know, decides that you're already having, you know, ransomware. You know, ransomware is already scary and uses elements of AI to learn how to adapt and evolve. It's not getting less scary. It's getting more scary to me, you know. So that's my take on it. You know, I'm not talking Skynet, you know. I'm talking, you know, ransomware times 1,000.
Well, on that cheery note, let's go ahead and move on to picks. We're going to skip Journey Quest this week because we want to wait for Bri. But picks, do you got something that you want to shout out? Aside, of course, from The Naturalist, the number one book on Amazon, which you can go right now if you are a Prime member. You can get that Kindle copy for free because it is a Kindle first all this month. So go ahead and check that out. That is The Naturalist by Andrew Main, number one book on Amazon, folks. This is not a drill. Weird Things put a number one book on Amazon. We're going to talk a lot more about that in After Things. So, of course, that is everybody's pick. But, Andrew, do you have anything else?
Still enjoying Rick and Morty. You know, Game of Thrones is vanished. And so left with, what do I do? How do I entertain myself? And, you know, I'm just waiting for more Rick and Morty.
Can I just say this? And my pick's going to be Rick and Morty as well, because I don't want to shout out the book that I'm reading right now because it's political and it'll just be a political thing. So, but I am reading Devil's Bargain about Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. And I have thoughts. That's going to be our new book club pick on PX3. So if you're into that, listen to Politics, Politics, Politics. But I'm going to double down on Rick and Morty. And I want to tell you this. Andrew, I've been going to Dragon Con for, geez, now, probably 7 years, 7 or 8 years, something like that. And the one thing that I always like to track is who the winners and losers on cosplay are. I find that to be my kind of like geek barometer on like what's resonating with a certain element, a very passionate and influential element of geek culture. And far before Deadpool lit it up at the box office, Deadpool was the costume at Dragon Con year after year after year. People love Deadpool. They love doing the mashups of the Deadpools. They love dancing around. It was always a fun, there was a Deadpool culture that was very excited when they did a movie that they found good, right? I will say this. Rick and Morty was the biggest gain I have ever seen year on year at a Dragon Con. It was explosive. The Rick Sanchez costume was the new Deadpool. So many Rick Sanchez Rick Sanchez is running around, and extraordinary costumes that were from episodes that aired like weeks before. Like it was remarkable. Talk about Rick and Morty so I can find pictures of this.
So you've had the photos coming out, like the Vindicators episode, which just came out a little while ago. Now, we had a peek at the Pickle Rick before, so you could know Pickle Rick was coming. But Vindicators, and, you know, fans pay attention and look for clues of what's coming out there and doing that. But you have people who, that entire culture of, you know, cosplay culture of trying to do this and celebrate that is absolutely amazing. If you've not watched this show, I recommend it. I'm not a guy that goes on and on about cartoons. I love Rick and Morty because if you love sci-fi, but you're at that point where you can see a plot a mile away, you know, Rick and Morty surprises you and delights you because it's not about that. Here we've got Pickle Rick and Morty from that was like episode 3 or something like that.
That was from I think the second episode where his arm gets haunted by an old warrior. Just his arm haunted by an old warrior.
Just incredible cosplay. Like, yeah, the Vindicators one is fantastic.
Yeah, let me go ahead and try to find this Vindicators cosplay. But I will say this. So I was talking about this at the one of the bars in DragonCon yesterday. And I'm talking like, man, oh my God, Rick and Morty, just over the top. And I'm like, yeah, apparently the Vindicators were out there yesterday. I didn't get a chance to see it. The guy next to me, he goes like, yeah, I was Ghost Train. they were only down millions of a million of ants and Croculot.
Official Rick and Morty Twitter, their links to that
okay.
on there. They have a very funny joke as why million ants wasn't there. why million ants and cyber or Crocborg or cyber croc wasn't there.
Crocubot,
yeah.
Here we go.
A very funny Rick and Morty response to that.
This is again, and this is not just like, you know, a Halloween cosplay. This is pro costume, this is what you would see at a theme park, right? Like,
yeah.
Which is just amazing. A, it speaks to kind of how, how far DragonCon has come in terms of showcasing that community. But at the same time, I really do think that there's just something to that show that has captured the zeitgeist. And I do think part of it is, I think for me and you, we love it because it is a writer's show, right? It's a show that wants to make sure you do not know where it is going and thinks around the corners. So you are always kind of surprised by it.
There's check the feed. Cause there's check the caption they gave to that photo, which is really hilarious.
Oh, this is a quick, let's get a group shot. While million of ants and Croggybot are taking 1 million and a half, S words.
And that's funny. And then they have an official response when Elon Musk was asked if he liked Rick and Morty.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, you got to find it. Because he said, like, yeah, we find it kind of, my boys and I, it's kind of disgusting, but my boys and I love it. And then the official Rick and Morty response. So here you have this irreverent cartoon show responding to, a billionaire with about $20 billion leading the frontier of space flight, electric cars, whatever, an absolute pioneer who's talking about this show and their response to him. This is the world we live in, folks.
Crazy, man. Anyway.
That's some amazing fan art there, too. Just amazing fan
art. Yeah, Rick and Morty, no new episode this week, but new episode next week. Just great work. Great work. And listen, this was a season that was delayed for a long time because they wanted to make sure that, you know, in Dan Harmon's words, that the writing was something that they were proud of to follow up that second season that by and large everybody liked. So far, so good, if that is the case.
I'll paraphrase, and it was, we look forward to disgusting the rest of the Musk family.
Oh my God. Amazing. Amazing work. Amazing work. Okay. Well, I feel like that's going to wrap it up. Andrew, any final words?
I've got no more words. Thank you so much for everybody that supported The Naturalist. I could not be more excited about the response I've been getting. I'm over the moon. To have it, you know, even debut in the top 10 was phenomenal. And we'll get into this in after things and talk a little bit more about that. So, but anyhow, thank you. For all you do listen to us, this podcast, check out, you can pre-order it now. Two. So October 1st is when it officially drops.
Get that free copy if you're a Prime member. And yep. Also, if you're a Prime member, consider giving your Twitch subscription to us at twitch.tv/nightattack, which is where we air this show live, usually Mondays. But today, it's Tuesday at 11:30 Pacific. That is, what is that, East Coast? 2:30? 2:30 East Coast. Yeah. Anywho, go ahead and check us out, twitch.tv/nightattack. Until next time.
It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.